FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and today is 2/28/20, last business day of the month. What a month it's been. We've got pandemics breaking out all over the globe. We've got stock markets crashing, precious metals soaring. What is going to happen next? That's the question. Well, what do you think is going to happen next? What's your take on what is happening now? Email us, kl@kerrylutz.com. Well, just Monday, the Supreme Court refused to allow an injunction against the Trump administration's public charge rule. If you're not familiar with that, basically requires that legal immigrants to the United States meet a certain threshold, income threshold, and if they're receiving benefits, whether it's housing allowance, which would be Section 8, or food stamps, or any other plethora of benefits that are beneficent government makes available to people, then it's going to be very difficult for you to get a green card and eventual citizenship. Well, going to talk about that. Steve Maggi is with us now. Steve's an attorney and a former immigrant, naturalized U.S. citizen, who big law firm, and now his firm helps individuals and companies worldwide with their version of the American dream. Steven, it's great to have you on. So, public charge. So,
thanks for having me.
Hey, so effectively, the Supreme Court, by refusing to allow the preliminary injunction, has said that the government was going to effectively prevail on the merits, and there's no reason to keep an injunction in place. And I think there's also some issues about whether a federal judge has the right to do an one federal judge in a district, could be in Alaska or Hawaii, whether he has the right or she has the right to do a nationwide injunction. I don't know that they really got to the merits of that yet, but that certainly is going to be on the table. But more importantly, so we've got this public charge rule. It's always been in effect since we developed an immigration system, which says basically, you're welcome to come to the country if you meet the qualifications, and you won't be a burden to the public. So how is this rule changing anything?
Well, it's just become so much more amplified. It's so much more broader than it used to be. This is sort of akin to a fight, a boxing match, where the administration has done these sorts of things before and thrown punches in different rounds. But essentially, this is, to me, a knockout punch by the Trump administration in terms of how it deals with legal immigrants in this case, and how it aims to exclude as many of them as possible from coming into the U.S., as well as trying to find a way, like you said, to deny them benefits such as a green card or perhaps becoming U.S. citizens when they're legally here. And that's because this final rule allows any U.S. immigration official to broadly apply the law and use the standard obscure. It's a very gray area standard, which allows them essentially carte blanche to deny benefits. And that could mean potentially somebody falling out of status if they're in the U.S. and having to leave, or somebody that's outside the U.S. waiting or applying for a visa and not being able to enter the United States.
Okay, so there's really two issues here. Number one is, well, should there be a requirement that people wanting to immigrate to the United States, that they not be a burden on the public through receiving benefits like food stamps, housing vouchers, SSI, Medicaid, and a host of other programs? Is it right to expect that new entrants to the country are going to carry their own weight?
I think there is definitely some logic to that thinking, and it's important to understate that the to underscore, sorry, that this concept of inadmissibility on public charge grounds has existed since 1883. It's not something new. The difference is that now it's going to be applied in such a broad way that it essentially it can penalize people that may have received help, but the law, the rule also says that if they are likely to in the future receive or have the need to receive public benefits, they could be excluded. So these are people, when you're talking about people who are applying for visas from the outside, who have not lived in the U.S. and they have never applied for public benefits because they haven't lived in the U.S. But if the person says, because of your age, your health condition, your educational level, for example, which are some of the factors which are enumerated in this law, they look at the totality of the circumstances and they say, based on our evidence, we think it's more likely than not that in the future you may become a public charge. And that's enough grounds for them to deny someone a visa. So it's not just people who have in the past 3 years received any of these benefits that are listed. It's people who could hypothetically do so based on these factors, which is really frightening.
All right. So, but now the goal of the administration has been to implement merit-based or to basically have a system whereby people who possess skills in need, in demand in the country are given a priority or basically given the opportunity to immigrate. And those low-skill employees, or I should say low-skill immigrants, people who haven't been to college, whatever, and find it difficult or might find it difficult in the future to earn a living, so to keep them out. So isn't this effectively a rule-based method of applying merit-based immigration?
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next.
Silver One Resources is an exploration and development company backed by strategic investors Eric Sprott and SSR Mining. At Silver One's Candelaria Mine project in Nevada, there is already a historic resource estimated at 127 million ounces of silver, which Silver One is developing and advancing. The company's Phoenix Silver Project, located within the Arizona Silver Belt, is an early-stage exploration project on which native silver vein fragments have been discovered near surface. One grab sample assayed an astounding 14,688 ounces per ton. Yes, that's right, ounces, not grams. Silver One has tremendous exploration potential, is extremely leveraged to the price of silver, and is cashed up and poised to increase shareholder value. Silver One trades in New York under the ticker SLVRF and in Toronto under the ticker SVE. To learn more, go to SilverOne.com. That's SilverOne.com.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Well, I think it's ironic. That's a great question. I think it's ironic in the media is what's been happening in the past 3 years, which is the fact that the administration is denying a higher percentage of merit-based visas like the H-1B, which is for skilled workers or essentially people who have university degrees, which includes a lot of foreign nationals who get their degrees in the U.S., like engineers, for example, software developers. The percentage of those cases is being denied has tripled in the past 3 years, whereas the low-skilled worker equivalent, which is called H-2B, seasonal workers, such as the ones that worked at Mar-a-Lago that President Trump used to actually sponsor, those are going through without any issue, and they're being maximized. And the total number of visas that are possible for H-2B for the low-skilled workers are being maximized, while the ones for professionals are being denied at a 40% clip. And that means that there's a hole there. There's a necessity for those people that's not being filled. So I think it's actually the opposite. The platform was merit-based system, but I think it's actually...
Yeah. So you think it's actually standing on its head. On the other hand, the big tech companies, who are the primary beneficiaries of the H-1B visa, your Googles, your Apples, all of them, they've used it and abused it in the past to bring in lower paid foreign workers, programmers, etc., to cut their costs and cut Americans out of jobs. I mean, it has happened, correct?
Yes. So there's been documented cases of that. And what Immigration Service has done since then is essentially they've not accepted that lower level wage, that what's called skill level one wage anymore. So if you're applying for H-1B, you have to at least apply at level two, which means a 15-20% raise in salary for anyone that's being brought in, which essentially equalizes the playing field. It levels the playing field so that the foreign workers should be getting paid what any American worker would get being paid. So I don't think that's really an issue anymore, but it certainly was in the past few years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm not sure what the differential was, but I had heard that it could be as high as 100%. You know, these were six-figure earners that they were bringing in, the Americans, to replace American jobs. But with outsourcing and all that, probably such is less meaningful than it used to be. But the question is, how do you screen effectively prospective immigrants to be sure that we don't get abused like we have in the past? I mean, I know in New York State, where I used to live, basically any illegal immigrant can get Medicaid. They don't ask status or anything, even though the law says they're not allowed to do it. It's federal funds, all that. They're not allowed to give it to illegal immigrants or people who are here. I know we're talking about legal immigrants, but the point is that, you know, the benefits, do we want to be giving people benefits who are coming from other countries to the United States rather than traditionally, like I'm sure your family who came here to worked their way up the ladder. We got a problem with deficits and runaway programs. We got to have some kind of screening. So what is the way to do this?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very broad question. I don't like to inject my own personal opinion in these matters, but I think that, first of all, it's important to say that I would never help somebody do things illegally. So I was the one who waited till I was 21 to have my first drink. I'm very respectful of the law as it stands. And as the law changes, I have to adapt to that. But my goal is to always make sure that my clients are doing things by the letter. And so when they ask me now, what should they do with regards to the final rule? I will tell them, make sure you're not receiving any of the assistance that's listed here, because this is forward. This is going forward. Now that you've been essentially made aware of what the law says, it's your responsibility to not accept this. And if you do, these are the ramifications. Yeah. What scares me about the standard now is this more likely than not probability standard, which is saying essentially it's up to that adjudicator to do a balancing and be able to deny cases of people who have never presented a public charge and have never received aid. The public rule says inadmissibility, it's referring primarily to people who are outside the U.S. and what makes them eligible or not to enter the U.S. Mm-hmm. That's really the people that are most affected by this, because they essentially could all be denied based on one of these factors that's enumerated.
Right. And look, picking $60,000 in New York, they might be going to New York and have a job lined up for $60,000. They come to Mississippi, $60,000 job is a lot of money and less likely to meet that threshold. So the question is, rather than rulemaking, what does the Congress and the president need to do to effectively address this situation without hurting people that we want, that the country needs by any stretch? I mean, you look at the job market, you know, how do you filter them out? Because we need a legislative solution to this, not a administrative solution.
No question. I mean, the problem with the last three administrations has been that essentially the immigration laws have never been changed. And so all these executive orders and final rules are essentially this Wild West kind of situation where the executive branch, because it's essentially in control of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, is allowed to reign over this and decide at will how they want to apply the law without the laws being changed, which means there's no consensus here. It's just the executive branch saying this is what we want. And I think that this administration really is anti-immigrant in many ways. And what the message that's lost here is that for every case, and most of these cases are not that have come under the final rule, don't have to do with employment cases or cases where people are sponsored for jobs.
Yeah, right.
Because all the forms for family cases have changed, and they've added three pages of these. Have you done this and received these benefits? For each person that's being sponsored to come to the U.S. or to adjust status here to become a green card holder or applying for citizenship, they're doing it through a U.S. citizen, spouse, parent, or child, which means every time somebody's denied a benefit or they're denied entry to the U.S. because they don't get a visa to come here, their U.S. citizen family is being affected. This is potentially going to destroy with U.S. citizen sponsors. And that affects not just the immigrants, but that affects Americans.
Yeah, well, so some solution. Obviously, there's a concern here and something needs to be done about it. And, you know, maybe the administration isn't going about it the best way. What's the rationale for allowing in H2s, but not H1s? I mean, I'm not quite aware of that.
It's ironic because I don't understand the rationale for a lot of the policies that are being enforced by the administration, including this public charge ground rule that will affect people getting visas and people who are, you know, family members of U.S. citizens. To me, it really doesn't make sense. It's illogical, as is excluding people who we really need and including people that maybe we don't need quite as much.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing is that the study that was taken, and I don't know how accurate it is, I didn't check the methodology, but said somewhere around 62% of all immigrants to the country are on some form of welfare, which was far greater than Americans. So the need is there definitely to reform this system, because we want people here who are going to work. And I mean, everyone agrees on that. It's just, how do you get there? And really, that's the drain on resources. I mean, look, if we didn't have a welfare state, we could let anybody in. They'd have to make it on their own, right? But with the welfare the welfare state makes all of this immigration screening necessary, doesn't it?
Well, I think the real question is, from that percentage, and who knows how accurate these statistics are, but assuming that 62% is correct, I would venture a guess that 3/4 of that 62% are probably illegal immigrants versus legal immigrants. Meaning most of the immigrants that are coming to the U.S., if they're being sponsored by an employer, they're going to get paid, so they won't need public assistance. And if they're being sponsored by a U.S. citizen, and show that they have the sufficient funds to make sure that that person doesn't become a public charge. And so I think the real issue here is, why are people eligible for welfare or some of these benefits that you talked about when they're illegal? And that's really the issue. Like I said in the beginning, I don't purport to help people do things the wrong way or do it, you know, work around the system. What I do is to help people that we really need in the U.S. to come here and to be able to be efficient and set up their companies and create jobs and actually contribute to the U.S. economy, right? And the social and cultural fabric and all that. The ones who are illegal, I think, are the ones, most of them are the ones who are receiving these benefits and shouldn't be doing so.
Yeah. So we got to find some type of way to address this. It's got to be done legislatively rather than piecemeal. That's the other thing, because you get a bunch of these policies, and as we see, they work against each other in a lot of instances. And, you know, I think everybody's just got to come to the table. But in the meantime, injustices are going to be done and people are going to be hurt. And hey, you've been a lawyer a while. You know how the system works, right?
I do. And my dream has always been that it was passed through Congress and that there was a cohesive plan in place that everybody could agree on, at least the representatives that we put in Congress. Right. Unfortunately, it has become the Wild West. And I think that it's become so political. Like Justice Sotomayor said, you know, this has become too political. The Supreme Court is kowtowing to the executive branch. And I think that means that the separation of powers is also falling off that balance that we've always wanted for this country. And so I think that is a problem. And I think it's teetering more and more, and it's going to fall off completely if we keep going in this direction.
Yeah, well, it is a problem. And unfortunately, the court's got to be the one to step in. We do have this concept of judicial deference to the executive and to the legislature, too, for that matter, that a law is presumed basically constitutional and valid until proven otherwise. So I don't know what the solution is, but certainly what we have now, we need a holistic kind of policy here, because nobody can deny that there are problems with immigration, both legal and illegal. So in any event,
absolutely in agreement, totally in agreement.
We got to do something. So, hey, if you could just tell us, Steve, how we find out more about you, where to read your work and connect with you on the web.
Sure. Yeah. Our website is www.smalawyers.com. And anyone can email any questions they have to me at smaggy@smalawyers.com whenever they want. We have, you know, videos and reviews, et cetera. And we're happy to give anybody the information that they need so they understand really where they stand, because it's becoming more and more convoluted. These waters are getting murkier by the day, and people need someone to tell them exactly where they stand. So I'm happy to be, I'm available for anybody who has questions.
All right, excellent. And we'll have a link to your site in the show notes to this interview. Don't forget, questions, comments, kl@carrielutz.com. That's the email address. Twitter feed @CarrieLutz. Facebook page is Financial Survival Network. And the home site, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Steve, appreciate you coming on, and keep up the fight.
Thanks so much, Kerry.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.